brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
You're listening to CHM Live Radio. I'm Lauren Miyamoto, and I produce the museum's live speaker series. Each year, we bring incredible guests to the museum to talk about computing and the transformational effect it's having on our society. We've hosted a wide range of speakers, from geneticists and asteroid miners to technology giants like Elon Musk and Sheryl Sandberg. Today's episode features Michal Kaczynski, an associate professor at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. He uses AI and big data to study things like your Facebook likes or profile pictures to determine traits like sexuality, political views, and even how extroverted you are.
This information, of course, contains trail of our behaviors, thoughts, feelings, social interactions, communications, purchases, even the things that we never intended to say.
So what is it about social media data that can reveal personality traits? How are companies and politicians using technology like this already? And what does this mean for our privacy? Find out in this conversation between Michal Kaczynski and David C. Brock, the director of the museum's Center for Software History. It was recorded in May 2017.
I'm a computational psychologist, which means that I'm working mostly with data, in particular big data. So instead of spending time with the research subjects in my lab or running small experiments or maybe learning about people using surveys, I would look at the digital footprints that you so nicely introduced before that we're all leaving behind while using digital products and services. And it's a great time to be a computational psychologist. It's a great time to be me at the moment because you guys are leaving, well, we all leave an enormous amount of digital footprints behind. Back in 2012, IBM has estimated that we're leaving about 50 megabytes of digital footprints per day per person, which is an enormous amount of data. If you wanted to back it up on paper, by printing it out on paper, zeros and ones, letter-sized paper, double-sided, font size 12, and you wanted to stack it up, and it's just one day worth of data, the stack of paper would be like from here to the sun four times over. So we're all generating enormous amount of information, and now this information, of course, contains our trail of our behaviors, thoughts, feelings, social interactions, communications, purchases, even the things that we never intended to say. Like, not sure if you guys realize that if you type a message on Facebook and then you decide, okay, it's 2 a.m. and maybe I drank too much wine, I shouldn't probably be sending it, and you abandon the message, you just close the window, guess what? The message is still being saved and analyzed. And in my research, my main goal is to try to take this data and learn something new about human psychology or human behavior. And one of the byproducts of doing that is that I will produce models that take your digital footprints and will try to predict your future behavior. Maybe we'll try to predict your psychological traits, such as personality, political views, religiosity, sexual orientation, and so on. And, well, what was really shocking to me when I started working in this field is how accurate those models are. So this is one shocking thing. The other shocking thing, in fact, is that those models are also very difficult to interpret. So I know that a computer can predict your future behavior. I know that a computer can reveal or determine your psychological traits from your digital footprints, but it's very difficult for a human scientist to now understand how exactly a computer is doing it. And I worked with Facebook likes quite a lot, not because Facebook likes are the best type of digital footprint we are leaving behind, not at all. In fact, Facebook likes are not so revealing. Why? Because liking happens in a public space. So when you like something on Facebook, you probably realize that now your friends will see what you have liked. So you wouldn't like anything really embarrassing or maybe something really boring or something that you want to hide from your friends. But now, when you use your web browser or you search for something on Google or you go and buy something, you basically have much less choice. You kind of will search for things that you would never like on Facebook. You would visit websites that you would never like on Facebook, and you would buy stuff that you would never like on Facebook. Like, you would buy medicine that is very revealing about your health, and, you know, most of us don't really like the medicine we are taking on Facebook. Which basically means that if someone can get access to your credit card data, your web browsing data, your search data, records from your mobile phone, these digital footprints will be way more revealing than whatever I can do using Facebook likes. So whatever findings I'm coming up with, they are just conservative estimates of what can be done with more revealing data. And you can actually see that the entire industry, or entire industries, not just one industry, they are moving towards basically building their business models on top of the data we are producing. And my favorite example is credit cards. Think about it for a second. A credit card is this just amazing, magical thing that allows you to pay for stuff without carrying cash around. There's a complicated network behind it, computers crunching data, and so on. Now, we're not paying for it. Why? Because we are the products of a credit card company. And when you actually, it's not a secret, you can go to the website of a Visa or MasterCard or any other credit card operator, and you will see that they see themselves not as a financial company anymore. They started as a financial company that was helping to channel payments. Now they see themselves as a consumer insights company. By observing the things you're buying and when you're buying them and how much you're spending. On the individual level, they can learn a lot about you, but also they can see, extract interesting information on the broader level. When they see that, you know, recently people in San Francisco started buying certain things or going to a certain restaurant or whatnot, this is a very valuable information that can be sold. So basically, if you're not paying for something, you're most likely a product. So now think about your web browser that you probably didn't pay for, your Facebook accounts, your web searching mechanism, and one of the gazillions of apps that you have on your phone. And now think about how much data you're sharing with the others.
Your use of Facebook likes as a, I guess at the time initially, as a graduate student at the University of Cambridge, correct? And at the time, I believe, Facebook likes were public. Anyone could see your Facebook likes. Is that what led you to use that data?
Yes, you're just pointing out here that that's another reason why I'm using Facebook likes, which is that I was very lucky to get a huge data set of volunteers that donated their Facebook likes to me. So back in 2006 or 2007, my friend David Stilwell, he started this online personality questionnaire where you could take your take a personality standard personality test, and then you would receive feedback on your scores. And it went viral. We had more than 6 million people that took the test, and half of them generously gave us access to their basically Facebook profiles. So when you finish your test, we would ask you if you would be willing in return for us offering you this interesting thing, if you would be willing to give us access to your Facebook profile that we would later use for our scientific research. And more than 6 million people, in fact, took the test. So we got around 3 million profiles, Facebook profiles. In my case, I kind of stumbled by accident, kind of got into this research by accident. What happened is that I was developing traditional personality questionnaires. And traditional personality questionnaires, they're composed of questions such as, I'm always on time at work, or like I like poetry, or I don't care about abstract ideas. And I had this data set of Facebook likes where basically people like poetry, or they like I don't like abstract ideas, or like I don't like to read. And what struck me is that why would we even ask people this question if we can just go to their Facebook profile, look at their Facebook likes, and just, you know, fill in the questionnaire for them. Mm-hmm. And so I started running those simple machine learning models that would take your Facebook likes and try to predict what would be your personality score. And this worked pretty well, which, you know, actually was pretty disappointing for me because I spent so much time developing those bloody questionnaires, and now here a computer can do the same thing in a fraction of a second for millions of people. But then we had other data in our data set. So we were like, okay, so we can predict personality. I wonder if you can predict political views, religiosity, sexual orientation, and bunch of other, whether your parents were divorced or not. And each time we asked this question, computer would think for a few seconds and said, yeah, of course you can predict it. This is the accuracy. It's amazing. In fact, we were pretty suspicious. So at the beginning, I would rerun the models with independent pieces of data or rewrite my entire code, thinking that I must be doing something wrong, given that a computer can look at your Facebook likes and predict with very high accuracy, close to perfect, whether you're gay or not. And you know, people don't really like anything obviously gay on Facebook. Well, some do, but it's like a very small fraction of people. For most of the users, when we're running those predictions, this was just really based on the movies they watched or books they read. And it looked very counterintuitive to me at the time that you could do it. Now, that I'm a bit older and I spent some more time running those models, it's actually pretty obvious. And let me illustrate it for you guys let me kind of try to offer you a short introduction to how those models work. This is actually pretty intuitive. Look, if I told you that there is this anonymous person and they like Hello Kitty, it's a brand, I'm told. You would probably be able to figure out, if you know what Hello Kitty is, that this person is most likely female, young, an iPhone user, and you could probably go from here and make some other inferences about her. And you will be actually very correct. 99% of people who like Hello Kitty are women. Most of your Facebook likes, or most of your purchases on Amazon, or most of the locations that you visited with your phone recording it, or most of the search queries that you put in Google are not so strongly revealing about your intimate traits. But it doesn't mean they're not revealing at all. They are revealing, some of them to a very tiny degree, but they're still revealing. So the fact that, let's say, you listened to Lady Gaga 30 times yesterday, it's not only a bit weird, it does also show us something about your musical taste. But it also for sure reveals to some tiny extent your sexual orientation, your political views, your religiosity, your personality, your intelligence, and virtually any other psychological trait or behavior that you would like to predict. It's just that this amount of information that is there is really tiny. So for a human being, this is useless. But now what a computer algorithm can do, it can get this tiny bit of information and aggregated over thousands of digital footprints that you're leaving behind to arrive at the very accurate prediction of what your profile is. And this is basically the paper that I published in 2013, and I was very excited about the promises of this technology, and I'm still excited about promises of this technology. It's used to improve our lives in many different ways, and we don't even realize in how many ways it's used to improve our lives. And if you don't believe me, think about Netflix, or Spotify, or Facebook newsfeed, which is so engaging that people spend, you know, 2 hours a day on average, if I remember correctly, looking at it. Now, they don't look at it because it's so bloody boring and not pleasant to do it. They look at it because the AI behind it made a very accurate prediction about what your character is and then adjusted the message in such a way as to make it most engaging. Now, there are also downsides, as I'm sure we'll be talking more about today. And, well, and this was basically the paper that I published in 2013. Right. It got quite some press coverage. But at that time, most of the press coverage was like, look, guys, this is so cool. You can predict whether someone is, I don't know, a Republican from their Facebook likes. Nice, shiny gadget. And I was like, no, but wait, you have to realize it has tremendous consequences for the future of our society. And people were like, no, it's just so cool that you can predict it from likes, but this is as far as we go. But now, interestingly, this is how general public treated those results, but policymakers and companies, they really took notice. So for instance, 2 weeks after those results got published, Facebook changed their privacy policies in such a way that Facebook likes were no longer public. So before 2013, I think it was March when we published the paper, before that, likes were public for everyone to see. So I didn't even have to be your friend on Facebook to see everything you liked. But now our paper, our work showed that by seeing what you liked, I also can now determine your sexual orientation, your political views, and all of those other intimate traits that people are not happy to share. So I think it was a great thing that Facebook took notice, and to preserve your privacy, they just basically switched that off. But you also had US governments and EU governments, they took notice and they started working on changing their legislation to protect their citizens from some of the shortcomings of this phenomenon.
Well, maybe let's pivot to talk about some of these political uses of this kind of work. I want to hear you talk about how private firms are using big data analytics akin to your work to shift voting results in one way or another by micro-targeting messaging that's defined by its intended persuasion rather than its accuracy. One of these firms is Cambridge Analytica, which is part of a network of interconnected, privately held firms that were, it appears, centrally involved in both the UK Brexit vote and the Trump campaign. Cambridge Analytica is a US firm, mostly owned by Robert Mercer, and until August 2016 had Steve Bannon as its vice president and corporate secretary. Cambridge Analytica reportedly employed social media data mining along with government records and data sold by corporations, as we just discussed, to develop a dossier on every US voter, which was first used by the Ted Cruz campaign and later the Trump campaign to micro-target their messaging and direct their ad buys to influence voters. Relatedly, a Canadian firm called Aggregate IQ has been a central consultant for this kind of thing with the various UK organizations that pushed for the UK Brexit vote, and Cambridge Analytica appears to be the owner of Aggregate IQ's intellectual property. So, Michal, can you tell us about how your work relates to this whole thing and how we should think about Cambridge Analytica's claims about the effectiveness of their work for the Trump campaign?
So first of all, we don't really know how effective Cambridge Analytica was. And interestingly, when you listen to Cambridge Analytica themselves, they started by saying how amazing and efficient they were. But then when they realized that, you know, governments are getting interested, and maybe when they realized that some things that they've done and it became public that some of those things were not entirely legal, they suddenly changed their spiel, and now they say, oh, it actually didn't work at all, and we're just making stuff up. which obviously means that they're either lying now or they were lying then, so it's difficult to say. What I can tell you for sure is that, first of all, we have a lot of evidence that we produce in academia showing that such approaches work really well. And we also see that it's not only Trump campaign or Brexit campaign, but we see all of the serious politicians now employing methods of this kind in their campaigns. And in fact, Barack Obama was the first major politician to do it on a massive scale. And I actually don't really remember any outrage, especially on the left side of the political spectrum at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton as well. Hillary Clinton not only spent three times more money than Donald Trump on doing personalized targeting on social media, but also hired way smarter people, in my opinion. So, yes, she lost, but she didn't lose because Trump was using some kind of magical methods. The difference in the outcome must have been caused by something else. So when people ask me, hey, can data analytics and personalized political marketing win the election? The answer is, well, yes and no. Yes, because it's a fact of political campaign. It's a fact of life when you're running a political campaign. But because everyone is using it, it's just not really giving anyone any unfair advantage. And the only unfair advantage here I can think of is of Barack Obama, who was the first one to use it on a massive scale, so it might have given him some unfair advantage then. But also, I think what people, because we as humans, we kind of like to focus on the negative. And look, it's great that we focus on the negative. This is this clearly is a great psychological trait, but let's put aside focusing on the negative and risky for a second. Let's think about advantages of politicians being able to personalize their message. There are a few very interesting outcomes of that people seem not to notice. One is, if I can talk with you guys one-on-one, because that's really what I can do on social media, I can use algorithms to help me as a politician to talk with you one-on-one about things that are most relevant to you. They run those algorithms to try to understand your character, your interests, your dreams, and your fears to make the message more interesting and relevant to you. Which, first of all, has one outcome, which is messages became more important. In the past, I could just say, yes, we can, spend gazillions of dollars on showing it on every TV station, and I could be successful. Moreover, I couldn't really do anything else because I lacked an ability to communicate with people one-on-one. So I had to settle down on some kind of average message that was a common denominator, a message that would reach the broadest range of the population, yet was not really particularly aimed at anyone. Now I can talk with you about things that are relevant to you and with someone else about things that are relevant to them, which means that the message, the content of the political program became more important. Now, it's not only that, because this in turn has another two important outcomes, I think. First one is that if I make a message more relevant to you, you become more engaged in politics. And look, this is great for democracy when we have voters more engaged and interested in the messaging they're getting. We just have more people engaged in politics, and this is just great, I believe. But second of all, it also makes politicians think about, okay, so what's important for you, David? Uh-huh. You know, in the past, I could just say, yes, we can. Now, I actually have to think hard about what's important to you. And thinking about it would perhaps make me update my beliefs about what my political agenda should be. And specifically when it comes to minorities. Look, if I can just broadcast my message on the TV, I focus on the majority interests, right? Because this is the logic of broadcasting. If I can talk with people one-on-one, I now develop interest naturally as a politician in what they have to say and what they're interested in. So this is the first change, more engagement and more importance of the message over emotional slogans. But the second change, and we've seen it in the recent election, we've seen politicians like Donald Trump, but also Bernie Sanders, bringing in people into the political process that traditionally were not so interested. They were disengaged with politics because they thought there's nothing in it for them. And I believe that even if you disagree with those new people that were brought to the political process, I think that you should still recognize that it's great for democracy when people are engaged in politics. Now, the other outcome of personalized marketing is that if I can talk to you about things that are relevant to you, I don't need to show you this slogan 20 times. I can just have one serious conversation with you through social media. I know I'm exaggerating now, but basically what I'm saying is that I don't need to spend so much money on communicating, because I can communicate with you using more relevant messages, which has another great outcome for democracy, which is decreasing the entry cost into politics. And again, we've seen it both in American election, we've seen it with both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, who were not establishment candidates. They didn't have much money compared with other politicians that were in the race. They also didn't have experience in running, you know, big scale presidential campaigns. So they had to basically do it on a budget and in a new way. So what they started doing, they started talking to people directly about the issues that people cared about. Which basically means at the end of the day, we had those two candidates, and you may disagree with one of them or with both of them, but I believe, again, it's great for the democracy that you don't need a lot of money and the backing from the industry and the backing from establishment to be a part of the political process. We've seen the same with Brexit, for instance. Again, I'm not a big fan of Brexit myself. It seems actually that even people who are campaigning for Brexit are not big fans of Brexit itself, but you know, some of this campaign was just this ragtag political militia that had no experience and no money, and yet they were able to enter the political process.
I'd like to challenge you a little bit on this characterization of it. You know, saying that this micro-targeting is producing messages that are more relevant, you know, the relevance of these messages is their persuasive quality. It has nothing to do with their accuracy. It has nothing to do with their positive contribution to civic discourse. It's the be-all and end-all of the messaging is persuasion. So what I see as the great danger in this sort of work is actually an assault on consensus reality. So if we are all if there's pervasive and endemic and ceaseless micro-targeting, especially of messages that are intended to be persuasive politically, you'll end up, a result of that that I fear, is that people will end up living in essentially different informational worlds and will no longer have the ability to agree on what reality is. And so how can you have a democracy if you can't agree on what is real or what is not real?
You know where there was perfect, what did you call it, consensual reality?
Consensus reality.
You know where there was perfect consensus reality? In Soviet Russia. Perfect. You had one TV station government approved, one Pravda, the truth newspaper government approved, and if you knew something that other people didn't know, you probably ended up in the concentration camp. And it's actually, I reacted too aggressively to that, but it's maybe because I actually was born behind Iron Curtain in a country where we had perfect information bubble. Right. And you know what? This bubble was exactly the same for everyone. America, luckily, tried to break this information bubble by dropping printing presses on parachutes to Poland so the underground press could spread some fake news, as the communist regime would call it. We have this myth now that people believe in, and you know what? I believed in as well for the longest time, which is everyone tells you, now we live in those echo chambers and information bubbles, and those recommender systems are giving us information that's crafted for us that somehow is making the society worse because we now know different things, our bubbles are not fully overlapping. And I was thinking, okay, this is bad, this is very bad, because everyone says it's bad, but then I actually, in the context of those findings, started thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And look, guys, I now very strongly believe, and I did some research on that as well, that it's not bad at all. So first of all, there's absolutely no evidence. Okay, let me start differently. Humans are just, we are just destined to live in an echo chamber. It's called confirmation bias in psychology.
Right.
And it basically means that if you have a certain worldview, and then you get a new information, and this new information contradicts your worldview, is not compatible, you will have a tendency to reject it. It's not that you always reject it, but you kind of like information that confirm your worldview a bit more. Now, this is not a bad trait to have. If you didn't have it, you would be crazy. Because any new information would be like, oh, of course, this aliens, interesting, you know, lizard people running the world, very interesting. No, like, luckily, we have this, some, like, our brains like to keep consistent mental structures there. So one of the effects is that we will have a preference for information that that confirms our views, and recommender systems recognize that, so they will give us more information that confirms our views. So we kind of living, all of us live in echo chambers. But now our echo chambers today are way larger than they have ever been in the history of humankind. And let me give you an extreme example. If you were born in a little town anywhere in the world, but let's say in America, 100 years ago, you only knew what your priest or a teacher or your, you know, community told you. And guess what? 99% perhaps of that was fake news. Now you're living in a society where there's not only other people like teachers and your friends at work, our social networks are much larger, and journalists are trying to constantly give you some additional information, get you out of your very small bubble. And also algorithms also enter the race and try to give you a personalized view of the world. What happens is that your bubble is expanding. Now, in the process of the bubble expanding, they also stopped perfectly overlapping. So now, if you, David, live in your bubble, mm-hmm. that, by the way, is larger than, you know, whatever bubble ever a human has occupied mm-hmm. before now, and I live in my growing bubble, but our bubbles grow apart, which sometimes makes me aware, oh my God, he's in a different bubble. Information bubble, tragedy, tragedy. Now, if you lived in Soviet Russia, you were never able to look at people who had different information bubbles. So you never thought about it. You never thought, oh my God, information bubbles. You were just happy and content living in this small, tiny echo chamber. Which brings me to a related topic of fake news. I did not see any evidence, and I really encourage you to send me some if you have any, that we are somehow surrounded by more fake news today than we were surrounded by 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 years ago. Quite the opposite. I'll take that. Yeah. Thank you. Quite the opposite. The amount of valid information that we have not only as a society, but also as each individual person in this room, is again way larger than whatever people had in the past. And one of the outcomes of us having so much valid information out there, and also being able to access any information that humanity has ever produced, including sensitive data, just with one click of your mouse on the internet, what happens is that if you have fake news, if you heard something, and if you've heard a story, you can very quickly debunk it. So now what happened in a present society, in a current society, is that we got so quick at debunking false stories that you basically hear the phrase fake news, fake news, fake news all the time, which somehow creates an impression, oh wow, we are all surrounded by fake news. Well, of course we are. There's a lot of fake information around, but it's also way less than ever in the history in the past.
I think, you know, from my perspective, having those bubbles overlap is a really important thing. But let's pivot and talk about some of your very interesting work that's going on right now, working with photographs of people's faces. Particularly Facebook profile pictures. And in recent talks, you say that these neural networks, machine learning algorithms that you employ, can identify a man as straight or gay by a picture of his face, or identify a woman as extroverted or introverted by a picture of her face. How is that possible?
Yes, in my recent work, I got interested in seeing whether computer algorithms can predict intimate traits, can determine intimate traits of people just based on a still image of their faces. And now when I mention it, especially when I mention it to my colleagues in academia, they usually say, oh my God, we lost you, Miha, you know. So became a pseudoscientist, and it's very bad. But what I think they keep forgetting is that, in fact, humans are great at predicting intimate traits, determining intimate traits of other people based on their faces. We are so good at it that we kind of really don't even realize we're doing it all the time. Let me give you an example. Gender is a pretty intimate trait. Yet you have no trouble determining gender from a very short glimpse of someone's face. Emotions are intimate psychological latent traits. Yet we can very quickly detect other people's emotions just by a quick glimpse on their face. Even when they're trying to hide their emotion, we still are able to detect it. Now think about race. Think about genetic issues. Like there are certain genetic disorders that we can recognize just by looking at someone's face, but also another kind of genetic expression of genes is recognizing that someone is a child of someone else. When you say, oh, you look like your father, what you're actually saying, you're saying, I see through your face your genome, and I see that your genome is similar to the genome of this other guy, and he seems to be your father. Now, humans are good at predicting those intimate traits, but we are not good at predicting other intimate traits like personality or sexual orientation or political views. And this might mean there is no information about your political views on your face, but it also could mean that your brain did not evolve or did not learn to extract this information from a human face. It might be that your sexual orientation is as clearly displayed on your face as your gender. It's just that the human brain doesn't do well at revealing it. And guess what? It seems that computer algorithms can basically do it pretty well. In terms of sexual orientation, the accuracy is more than 90% for distinguishing between straight and gay men. Personality predictions of personality are comparable with the short personality questionnaire. Now, how do computers do that? Well, it's actually, there's no easy answer to it because, again, it's this black box model that I would love to understand, but my human brain is basically too weak to do it. It seems that computers are great at picking little giveaways that are on our face, on our faces, and then putting together hundreds of little pieces of signal into an accurate prediction of a given trait, very much like with Facebook likes. And there's some evidence of that. One example is that if you take one picture of an extroverted person, you wouldn't know whether they're extroverted or not. But if you take 100 pictures of extroverted people and you overlay them on top of each other, make an average face out of it, suddenly even a human being is able to very accurately distinguish between an extrovert and introvert. So it seems that the information is there, it's just too weak for a human being to detect. But for a computer, it's pretty easy.
With the sort of neural networks that you're using to do this sort of classification work, I mean, they are explicitly and fundamentally, like, non-explanatory. They do things, right? You teach a classifier, you train a classifier on a bunch of pictures, and you tell it, you know, this, you know, yes or no, yes or no, yes or no, and then it starts to be able to, you know, identify cats, pictures, or whatever. But it's just a trained classifier, so whether it's picking up, in the case of your work, like on straight or gay male faces, is it detecting sort of subtle social and cultural information in the photography, or is it picking up, you know, something that's actually of the face? There's no way to know. Fundamentally, no way to know, right?
Well, we can test it. Let's say by changing morphological, by taking a picture and photoshopping some elements, like making your nose longer, shorter, or broader, or whatnot, and see whether a computer now would change your mind about you.
Okay.
And then by doing that, you can basically experiment with a computer, and then you can reveal what features of the face are predictive of being extroverted or introverted. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter whether those are morphological features or whether there's something cultural or maybe environmental that happens that allows the prediction. Because at the end of the day, what we see is that prediction is possible. And when people say, okay, so what if I somehow try to, you know, maybe change my hairdo and then fool the algorithm? Guess what? The moment enough people started changing their hairdo, algorithm would learn that hairdo is no longer revealing about a given trait and would just move on to use something else in the prediction. But what I think it's really crucial and really key in those studies showing that you can take a human face and predict their intimate traits is the following, that we can talk about introducing good policies and introducing good technologies that will protect our data from being used to reveal our intimate traits. But at the end of the day, it's very difficult to imagine this working out. Why? First of all, it's very difficult to police data. Data can move between across the borders really quickly. It can be encrypted, decrypted. It can be stolen without a person whose data was stolen even noticing. Organizations such as NSA cannot reliably defend their data, so how can we expect that we individuals will be able to protect our data? Which basically means that in the future, there will be just more data about us out there. Now, algorithms are also getting better at turning this data into very accurate predictions of our intimate traits, our future behavior, and so on. Moreover, even if you gave me full control over my data, there's still a lot I want to share with the others. I want this discussion to be available to people afterwards. I want my blog to be read by people online. I want my Twitter feed to be public. And most importantly, I want to walk around without covering my face. So if basically what my conclusion is that going forward, there's going to be no privacy whatsoever. And the sooner we realize that, the sooner we can start talking about how to make sure that this post-privacy world is still a habitable and safe and nice place to live in. And now when people say, oh no, how can you say that we should still work on technologies protecting our privacy? And I'm like, yes, let's do it. But you also have to realize that this is a distraction because it somehow makes people believe that maybe we could have privacy in the future. And this belief, I believe now, is completely wrong. And now just to also stress the importance of that, we're having conversation here about how invasions of privacy, how revealing our intimate traits can be used to, let's say, manipulate us in to buy products or maybe vote for political candidates. Mm-hmm. Well, creepy, makes me feel uneasy and so on. But we have to realize that outside of our Western liberal free bubble, losing privacy can be literally a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. Think about countries where homosexuality is punished by death. If a security officer there can take a smartphone, take a photo of someone's face, and reveal their sexual orientation, this is really, really, really bad news for gay men and women all around the world. And now think about political views. Think about other intimate traits like intelligence and so on. So basically, the sooner we make sure that we act, we think, we basically, as a basic and default assumption, take there's going to be no privacy in the world, How do we change the international politics? How do we make sure that lives of minorities, religious minorities, sexual minorities, political minorities in other countries are preserved even in the post-privacy world? I think this is the question we should be talking about now, and not how to change the policy to protect our privacy better. Because guess what? We already lost. We can win a battle, but we have completely lost this war already.
I do want to turn to some questions from our audience. Apparently, lots of people had this question. Can you change your digital profile by liking items you actually don't like or by searching misleading things, so sort of digital chaff to cover your tracks?
That's a great question, and it's a great question. But my answer would be no, you can't. Because maybe you can like some random things on Facebook, but first of all, this would make you look pretty weird to your friends. And people just wouldn't do it, right? Or like imagine posting like 100 status updates and only one of them is real and the rest is just some kind of random gibberish. No one would do it, not to mention that probably a computer would have no trouble figuring out which one of those 100 is an actual status update and which one is not. So no, you cannot do it because it not only would make all of those platforms such as Facebook and Google and Netflix and so on completely not fun anymore, but it also would make your life not fun. Imagine now with your credit card, you had to buy 100 random things and keep them in your house before you bought, you know, whatever you wanted to buy. So it's not possible. Moreover, let me give you, even with Facebook likes, it's not possible. Let me give you an anecdote here. So there was a TED Talk once that was talking about one of the results, that I wrote about in my studies. And this result was that people who have high intelligence, they tend to that people who like curly fries on Facebook tend to have higher intelligence. And again, the correlation actually is very tiny because just the fact that you like curly fries doesn't make you smart. But there's this little tiny correlation that when you combine it over gazillions of other likes, you can then reveal that a person has high IQ. So there was this TED Talk when this fact was mentioned, and next day, the popularity of curly fries on Facebook went through the roof. Like, everyone liked curly fries on Facebook. But guess what? Algorithm really quickly discovered that. So in next iteration of an algorithm, this is why we call it machine learning, because machine learning realized, okay, so curly fries is no longer diagnostic of high intelligence.
Does that suggest that it's like the pattern of data points rather than any particular data point that is where you have can find a signal for these traits? So obviously, although I am a devotee of curly fries, of course,
as we all are,
yes, as everyone in this room, you know, it's nonsensical that could have anything to do except by some Baroque argument that there's some cultural signal in liking curly fries. But here's another representative of a question that I think also many people asked. You argue that data analytics can be used to engage more people in politics, to which the writer of this question agrees. However, couldn't it also be used to dissuade voters from voting? Some argue that certain political parties benefit from lower voter turnout and may be incentivized to try and achieve this through the sort of thing we've been talking about.
That's a great point, and there's absolutely no question that trying to discourage people from voting is just an awful anti-democratic thing to do. But you guys have to realize it's not the fault of social media that this is possible. It's the fault of the cultural and legal environment in this democracy where it is okay to put, let's say, a negative advert on a TV telling bad things about the other politicians. So if you are concerned with people being discouraged from voting, I think that it would be, again, it would be probably impossible to come up with regulation that would prevent politicians from actually doing it somehow. Because maybe they won't do it themselves, they would just ask their friends in other countries to leash out some bots that will do this job for them. So at the end of the day, and also when I'm discouraging you from voting, I'm not saying, hey, guess what, don't go and vote. I would just make up a story and tell you about a pizza place. And so there are other ways, there are ways that are very difficult to police. So if you're concerned about people not going to vote, you have to think about smarter way of solving this problem than regulating social media or traditional media. Like, for instance, and again, I'm not an expert on political processes, but like one thing that comes to my mind is let's make voting an obligatory thing, not only the privilege, but also a duty that we have as citizens.
I'll just use my prerogative of interviewer getting in the last question, which was another very provocative thing that I saw in your work, in your recent talks, which is a suggestion that these sorts of classification algorithms could be used in the context of employment and employment decision making. And I think it'd be interesting, I believe that this is already at play in society. So if you could just tell us about what you see as your concerns about that and what you see as hopeful about that.
I wanted to focus on the positives for a second. So you guys remember those stories about, you know, first cars being introduced in the cities across US and Europe, and they had to like have these people running with the red flag in front of the car and warning everyone that a car is coming. So I'm just saying that how I want to open this conversation is that we had examples in the past where basically new technology scared people a lot and they focused just on the negative and had a tendency to overlook the positive changes that the technology is bringing. And you probably had more examples than just cars. And it's very much the same with the use of algorithms in hiring. There are plenty of shortcomings of algorithms in hiring, but you have to look at those shortcomings in the context. And the context is how we go about hiring people at the moment. And we're doing it in an awful way. Why? Because we're being unfair and racist and sexist and ageist. Mm. And even a very bad algorithm would be way less sexist and ageist and racist than even a very good recruiter. Why? Because we all in this room are racist and sexist and ageist. And if you don't think you are you're dangerous. Because you still are, you're just not taking steps to prevent yourself from damaging other and hurting other people and being unfair to other people because of those negative traits that all of the humans possess. So now when we go about hiring, how do we go about hiring people? We interview people. Now, interviews are great, especially for the interviewers to feel so important and empowered, but there's a lot of scientific evidence. It's one of the most well-established facts in industrial and organizational psychology that interviews have close to zero predictive validity of how well you perform at work. Now they have, apart from few jobs, if you're going to be a spokesperson, then it's important how likable you are in an interview. But for most of the other jobs, great majority of other jobs, this doesn't matter. Moreover, what happens is that when you interview people, you basically, what the interview is doing is measuring how much you like a person. And again, you like people that are like you. If you don't have a tattoo, and in your community no one has a tattoo, and there's this young lady with a tattoo on her arm, whatever you are telling yourself, you will like her less than someone without a tattoo because it's something unusual, new, strange, and so on. So now replacing biased humans with algorithms is going to bring more fair hiring and better hiring and recruitment decisions. And even in way more important contexts, like letting people out of the prisons or deciding on the length of the sentences. Mm. It makes me feel very uneasy when you're telling me that algorithms should decide on whether to put someone in prison or not. Well, it's still a judge that says, oh, you are going to be released now on your parole. But in fact, the judge is making this decision in many places in the U.S. It's already happening that the judge, before he or she makes her decision, they would get a printout from an AI algorithm telling her how likely this person is to reoffend. And guess what? The judge would just follow, because that's what people do, what the algorithm told him or her. And it makes me uneasy, but when you look at the effects of this policy, which is we can release 2 times more people from prison while keeping the reoffending rates stable, I'm also really hopeful, because it means that in the future, we'll have more free people out there, we'll have less people in prisons, while having as safe society as today, or safer, hopefully. It also means that in the future, we'll have people being hired in a more fair way than today, and being way more fulfilled by their jobs. So I'm actually pretty hopeful looking to the future of our human-AI interaction.
It's a very interesting take on the use and employment. It made me think of a phrase I heard recently, in contrast to a meritocracy, a mirrortocracy that comes about from these interviews where it's confirmation bias. I guess it's very important then that we make very good algorithms. I think we've come to the end of our time this evening. So, thank you very much for just a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
That was Michal Kaczynski, associate professor at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. Next time, you'll learn about AI technology that could enable your computer to understand your emotions. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of CHM Live Radio. This podcast is produced by Chanel Loren and me, Lauren Miyamoto. John Plute composed our intro music, and transitional music is provided by Lee Rosevere. You can learn more about our events and the museum at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.